said that they are facing a communication campaign against their actions. So yesterday,
and we've got 5 seconds. Sorry.
Yeah, okay. So the court of Ecuador resolved to say that former President Rafael Correa and former Vice President Jorge Glass were sent, guilty of the crime of bribery. So they are using this new to take away the attention of what is really happening in
Denise
Quito,
Heredia,
in
we want to thank you so much for being with us. Okay. Ecuador correspondent for Telesur speaking to us from Quito. Democracy Now! Working with as few people on site as possible. Thanks to our entire crew, especially Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to News Director, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hospitals in Oregon are asking for a $200 million rescue package to help fight the pandemic. Senator Bernie Sanders has ended his presidential bid, and a recent report has found the U.S. government is quietly seizing personal protective equipment and other healthcare supplies from the hospitals that need it most. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Wednesday in Oregon, there are 1,181 cases of COVID-19 and 33 people have died. Governor Kate Brown has extended the ban on in-person dining at restaurants and bars in the state indefinitely. The establishments can continue to serve food for takeout and delivery. In addition, the governor announced that in-person classes have been canceled in Oregon for the rest of the school year. Nationally, the number of known cases in the U.S. continues to grow quickly. As of Wednesday afternoon, at least 418,000 people across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and four U.S. territories have tested positive for the virus. At least 14,000 people have died. On Wednesday, New York State reported its highest number of coronavirus-related deaths in a single day. The death toll in the state is now 6,268, which Governor Andrew Cuomo noted is more than twice that of the September 11th attacks. The state has more cases than any single country in the world outside of the U.S. Globally, the pandemic has sickened more than 1.4 million people across at least 177 countries, As of Wednesday afternoon, at least 86,000 people have died. Authorities in Oregon are following a Portland man after he purchased a number of allegedly fraudulent COVID-19 test kits. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
Federal prosecutors in Oregon are on the case of an alleged COVID-19 test fraud after authorities intercepted a shipment of 100 unauthorized test kits sent from China to a man in Portland earlier this month. Authorities wanted to move quickly to keep the test kits from entering the public marketplace while a deeper federal investigation continues. As of now, it is still quite difficult to get tested for coronavirus, and there is no at-home test available. The only way to get tested in Oregon is through a healthcare provider. COVID-19 swab tests now run at least $1,000 through certain private insurers, and according to Oregon Live, cost even more if obtained through an FDA-approved lab test center. The unauthorized test kits were priced at 50 cents each.
Hospitals in Oregon are asking for a $200 million state rescue package as the coronavirus outbreak continues to drain their finances. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems wrote in a letter to Oregon Governor Kate Brown, quote, "While we are doing all we can to maintain the necessary workforce to serve our communities, hospitals cannot weather this storm without direct financial support." Although the state has made some moves to help hospitals, they may not be enough. Last month, the state directed the network of coordinated care organizations to shift the payment of $98 million it owes to hospitals to March instead of June. In addition, the federal stimulus bill passed by Congress includes $100 billion for hospital stabilization. However, little is known at this point on how that funding will be allocated. Rural hospitals are being especially hard hit. Due to the ban on elective surgeries and the state stay-at-home order, the revenue of some rural hospitals has decreased by 60%. Officials in Multnomah County are considering giving renters more time to notify landlords that they cannot pay rent amid the coronavirus pandemic. Officials would have to amend the county's current eviction moratorium to eliminate the deadline that requires renters to notify landlords by the first of the month. Instead, coronavirus-impacted renters would have to notify landlords as soon as reasonably possible. The change would reflect similar wording to Governor Kate Brown's executive order from last week that temporarily prevents landlords across the state from ending leases or evicting tenants who cannot pay rent. The executive order is in effect until July, but it could be extended. County Chair Deborah Cafori said, quote, "We've heard from folks in the community that some people couldn't even get in touch with their landlords or property managers, so it makes sense for us to make this change to be in concert with the governor's order," end quote. The order applies to people who have lost their jobs, as well as those who are facing unexpected childcare expenses due to school closures or coronavirus-related healthcare expenses. The county requires renters to submit proof, such as a letter from an employer, doctor, or other source that cites COVID-19 as an explanation for the hardship. The order also gives tenants up to 6 months from the end of the state of emergency declaration to pay, and late fees are not allowed. Multnomah County state of emergency is scheduled to end Friday, however, it will most likely be extended. Landlords who do not comply with the order could be sued by the tenant and may be liable to pay up to 3 times the tenant's monthly rent, as well as their legal fees and other damages. Cafori has also said that the county is working with Portland, state, and federal officials on potential rent assistance aid, but the program is still being organized. Students at Portland State University who are set to graduate this June received a terse email from administrators saying their graduation will take place online. Several student petitions have begun in response, asking for student involvement in the decision about their graduation and asking that the administration delay the graduation instead of moving it online. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Alana, a student activist at PSU.
I am joined by Alana, who is a student activist with the Portland State University Student Union, among other groups, and I wonder if you could just introduce yourself and tell us what's going on over at PSU during this COVID-19 pandemic.
Like Jenka said, my name's Alana. I organized with the PSU Student Union on and off for the past 5 years. I'm a women's studies major, and I also started a group called Jewish Voice for Peace, so I've done a lot of different organizing around different student groups over the years, and I recently was I mean, I'm scheduled to graduate in June, and so I've been just like going through my final classes, trying to finalize all my plans, and then in spring term, I guess PSU announced that classes were going online, which was expected, honestly, and I am glad they made that decision. But it was all very sudden, I think within like a week, and then we got an email saying that our graduation is going to be virtual, whatever that means, with like basically no other information about it, what it would look like no input from students whatsoever, just kind of like a short email that said like, your graduation is going to be online. We'll let you know what we know more about like in the following weeks to come. Your hard work is not going to be wasted. Hope you have a good summer. And it was basically just like a very short impersonal email sent to all the graduates. And it was very disheartening. So I, in my anger, in my organizing anger, I started a petition to postpone it instead of put it online. And in the following weeks, I did that 2 weeks ago. So it's gotten like over 1,000 signatures, and there's other petitions that are going around. So we've accumulated all the petition writers, and now I'm in contact with all of them. And there's, I think, like 8 petitions right now to bring a letter to the school and just put pressure on them to say we don't want our graduation to be virtual. We want it to be postponed. And that's basically the update. For now, the school has not said anything as a response. They said that they've seen the petitions, but they haven't responded to them.
And how is this kind of approach representative of the administration, the current administration at PSU, that doesn't show any kind of consultation or involvement of the student body in the decision making?
I think that's one of the reasons why I was so not surprised by this decision, is just that they, PSU, especially the Board of Trustees and the administration, really treat PSU like a business. I mean, I know all universities are businesses, but this school really claims to have like a global diversity lens and all of these big words that they love to stamp on posters and in their brochures and when they're giving like freshman tours around the school. But when it comes down to it, they really don't care about the interests of their student body at all. And if they did, they would have asked us and included us in that decision to postpone graduation instead of put it online. So, like, I really wasn't surprised. I was at every Board of Trustees meeting last year where they decided to keep armed security after they murdered a man named Jason Washington, whether it be this board or the board that was existed in 2016. I'm not surprised.
And in the petitions that are circulating, is there a suggestion as to when the graduation should be postponed until?
No, I didn't put any sort of, like, suggestion. I just really wanted, I think the main, I put a list of demands in my petition, but I think one of the main demands that infuriated me and others the most is that we didn't get a say in any of this process at all. It was just a decision made by the administration for us, like in a context of pretending like that they care, which was just like in this tiny email. It just was all very like, I think it's not even necessarily about when it's postponed. Like it could be in the fall. It could be at the end of summer. We're very versatile into figuring out when the date would be. But I think it's just the fact that we were not included at all in this decision. But it was really heartbreaking to just, I guess, like, begin to grieve the loss of this ceremony that a lot of us have been looking forward to for, like, 5 years, 7 years. And, like, and just know that, like, that decision was made for us already, and there was nothing we could do. It felt very powerless. And just in spite of everything, I think ceremonies like this, especially graduation, are one of the few things that at least I had to look forward to as a student. It's a big moment in someone's life, and to know that, like, that decision was just completely made already without our input at all was really, really disheartening.
People wanted to get involved, or if they wanted to support that petition, is there a website they can go to or somewhere they can find it online?
Right now, there's, if you wanted to, like, obviously sign all the petitions, if you go, I guess if you just type in, like, PSU postponement of graduation, there should be like a bunch that pop up, and you could sign. My name, my Facebook name is Alana Ray, and there's, I think it's public. You can find my petition on there on my Facebook, and definitely keep sharing it, please, because the more signatures we get, the more pressure that the school is going to feel to postpone instead of put it online. And yeah, just like, I don't know, I fully understand how mad we are about this decision. So I think the more people who know about it, the more people who keep talking about it and sign the petitions, we'll have a little more, we'll have more like fire to the fuel, basically. So I think any support is very good right now.
Well, thanks for that update. Again, we've been talking with Alana Goldman, who is an organizer there at Portland State University, and with the Portland State University Student Union and other groups. Thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Jinka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Portland Parks and Rec is deploying a number of park greeters to assist with educating the public about new social distancing practices at public parks. KBOO's Nat Moon has the story.
In a statement on Tuesday, the Department of Portland Parks and Recreation made it clear that even though the city's parks are open, people must still actively practice social distancing when visiting. PPNR will have park greeters at all parks and golf courses starting this week who will, quote, educate the public about how to use their park system safely and to explain what facilities are open or closed. The agency said greeters are already available at some sites with high traffic, and signs sharing public health guidance have also been posted at many parks and trailheads. Areas where social distancing is near impossible, like playgrounds, sports courts, and skate parks, have been closed since March 23rd. I'm KBOO's Nat Moon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 43. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 75. Today in history, it is Buddha's birthday, a holiday celebrated in much of Asia and in other parts of the world that commemorates the birth of Siddhartha Gautama, the founder of Buddhism. The quote of the day is from the Buddha, quote, "Thousands of candles can be lit from a single candle, and the life of the original candle will not be shortened. Happiness never decreases by being shared." Senator Bernie Sanders ended his campaign for the presidency today, giving Joe Biden a clear path to the Democratic nomination. The news came the day after the state of Wisconsin went ahead with a controversial in-person primary election, which Sanders had called on to be postponed. The Sanders campaign had raised $182 million by the end of February, compared that to the Biden campaign, which raised $88 million. Sanders said today, quote, "I cannot in good conscience continue to mount a campaign that cannot win and which would interfere with the important work required of all of us in this difficult hour." Despite this, he will stay on the ballot in all remaining states with primaries and continue to gather delegates. Encouraging his supporters to continue working on key issues, Sanders said, quote, "If we don't believe that we are entitled to health care as a human right, we will never achieve universal health care. If we don't believe that we are entitled to decent wages and working conditions, millions of us will continue to live in poverty." In an alarming development, hospitals around the country are reporting that the federal government has suddenly seized their PPE and healthcare supplies. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
Hospitals and clinics in 7 states have reported that the federal government is quietly seizing personal protective gear and other supplies meant for healthcare workers who desperately need them at this time. According to the LA Times, FEMA is not publicly reporting the acquisitions, nor has the Trump administration detailed how it decides which supplies to seize or what it intends to do with those supplies. Healthcare officials who have had materials suddenly seized have received no guidance whatsoever from the government about how or if they'll get access to the supplies they've ordered, stoking further concerns about how public funds are being spent and whether the Trump administration intends to fairly distribute medical supplies. This, of course, comes along with the alarming news that Trump fired the independent watchdog Glenn Fine, tasked with monitoring how the funds allocated for COVID relief are being spent. Though White House officials have stated they are allocating the supplies to where they're needed most, there is no information backing up this claim, and healthcare officials and workers have consistently been left in the dark on the matter. As a result, hospitals and healthcare workers have reported paying exorbitant prices or using unorthodox methods to get access to the necessary supplies. One thing is certain, the Trump administration has made it abundantly clear that healthcare workers and hospitals cannot rely on the federal government for the necessary supplies to fight the pandemic. I'm KBOO's Nat Moon.
Last night, President Trump again expressed support for slashing the payroll tax, the primary funding mechanism for Social Security and Medicare. The coronavirus stimulus legislation that Trump signed into law late last month includes a provision allowing some employers to stop paying into Social Security for at least the rest of the year. Eliminating the employer payroll tax payments would further weaken Social Security's trust fund. Michael Phelan, Deputy Director of Social Security Works, said regarding this development, quote, "Republicans will use the reduced trust fund as an excuse to destroy our Social Security system." The Washington Post reported that the Trump White House is considering proposing another payroll tax cut, as well as a capital gains tax cut, as a part of an additional coronavirus stimulus package. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks it's time to plant seeds.
Wisconsin shows the new normal. No longer a need to rig elections behind closed doors. The Repubs openly admit the more who vote, the less they win. Last night, Trump attacked voting by mail while admitting he recently did. And this morning, Bernie stopped his campaign, leaving Biden as our champion to defeat the orange menace. Trump's handlers know every COVID death is 100 frightened, malleable voters. They know we know 12,000's better than nothing. But as the lockdown stretches into summer, protesting will become an essential activity. How many miles of street can we clog marching 6 or 10 feet apart? Throwing my rage into the void of the internet is counterproductive. We need creativity fueled by rage, generosity fueled by rage in our better natures. We flex our strengths, resisting pressure and despair, avoiding self-destruction, not raging at whoever's close by. Let's use these sunny days, the ebullience of spring, to find more cohesion and connections, to sow the seeds of vegetables, flower, and community. Harvest will come. Most reapers are joyous. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Amidst the current crisis, a shortage of poll workers during yesterday's Wisconsin primary led to just 5 polling stations in Milwaukee instead of the usual 180. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Elections are supposed to be meaningful because they reflect the will of the voters and the will of the community. This election isn't going to, and I think that's a real concern.
Milwaukee voter and Democratic political consultant Sachin Chetta says yesterday's Wisconsin spring election and presidential primary during a pandemic was potentially life-threatening, and the perfect local weather made it more poignant.
It's a gorgeous day. People are stuck inside, and they're worried about their families. There are thousands of people who are unwilling to go to the polls.
The U.S. Supreme Court, with a conservative majority, ruled 5-4 against extending the deadline to return absentee ballots after the Republican-controlled state legislature and the Wisconsin Supreme Court blocked Democratic Governor Tony Evers' attempts to delay the elections. Robert Craig from Citizen Action of Wisconsin says the refusal to postpone was undemocratic.
So I would say it's both been confusing and traumatic, but that a lot of people work in elections have been very heroic, and the voters are being heroic today. Who is not being heroic are the people who are forcing this election to happen during a pandemic.
Chetta says there wasn't time for Wisconsinites to receive the absentee ballots to stay home and vote.
There are tens of thousands of people who legally requested an absentee ballot and just didn't get it in time. It either didn't come in the mail or a glitch in the system prevented them from getting a ballot. Now they have to choose between exercising their sacred right to vote or putting themselves in danger by going to vote in person. So we're going to see, I think, much lower in-person turnout.
Additionally, people aren't used to voting by mail, says Dana Schultz of Reform Coalition Wisconsin Voices.
Because Wisconsin has same-day registration, going and voting in person is part of our culture and part of the expectation that you can go and show up. And if you've moved, a lot of low-income and young people do all the time, that you can still participate in an election.
Many who ventured out to vote yesterday reported long lines. Only 5 of Milwaukee's usual 180 polling sites were open. Chetta says that makes social distancing almost impossible. Milwaukee's population is just over 25% African American, but Black people represent 80% of the city's COVID-19 deaths.
In places where poorer people and people of color are congregated, they have a greater challenge. They have to wait longer in line. They have to stand in bigger crowds. They have to go through voting venues that more people are walking through. And so those types of impacts really fall on the most vulnerable in our society. And I think it's absolute discrimination.
Also yesterday, Georgia representative and civil rights icon John Lewis endorsed former Vice President Joe Biden. President Trump got a new press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, from the ranks of his reelection campaign. And Democratic leaders condemned Trump's firing of Glenn Fine, an experienced inspector general, who was set to oversee trillions of dollars in stimulus. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. reported its highest death toll numbers from coronavirus yesterday. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Dan Raphael.
The U.S. suffered its highest daily death toll from coronavirus yesterday, with 1,858 people dying, including 806, over 43% of the national total, from New York City. America's first in the world in confirmed cases of COVID-19, with almost 400,000, but is currently third in fatalities behind Italy and Spain. A new CNN poll found that 55% of those questioned thought the federal government had done a poor job in handling the health emergency, an 8-point increase from a poll a week ago. Democratic leaders said today that they would support more emergency funding after the Trump administration requested another $250 billion to support small businesses.
Nicaragua's 74-year-old president, Daniel Ortega, has not been seen in public for almost a month, and many are worried he is ill or dead. Nicaragua's government has not closed the country's schools, shops, or borders, and has even sponsored large-scale political rallies, including a recent march through Mangala called Love in the Time of COVID-19. The health ministry has recorded only a handful of cases of infection and one death, numbers that seem doubtful for Latin America's most populous country. In daily broadcasts, Vice President and First Lady Rosario Murillo has insisted that Ortega continues to lead the country and sends, quote, affectionate hugs to the Nicaraguan people. Felix Maradiaga, a prominent opposition activist, said Ortega has, quote, been in a state of permanent quarantine for years, showing interest in nothing but himself and those around him. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kopanoglu, Jenka Soderberg, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bulkey. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring an interview with author Jana Lopez. 11:30, we're going to hear Words and Pictures, hearing from celebrated webcomics creator Ali Fitzgerald. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for another installment of We Are All in This Together, followed by News from the Boo.
We Are All in This Together, I am speaking with Shasta Kearns Moore. Shasta is a mother with two children with disabilities. The pandemic has hit people in a lot of different ways, and today I'm wondering if you could talk about the ways that parents who have children with disabilities are being affected in Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because on the one hand, a lot of parents of children with disabilities that I've been talking to, and myself included, feel like in a lot of ways it's business as usual because a lot of us had made a lot of the changes that everyone else is having to make right now, and all the realizations of how fragile life can be.
Can you talk about what some of those changes are that you've already made that now other people are making for other reasons?
Yeah, so I would say the realization of how dangerous germs can be. A lot of people that I know have had to self-quarantine, severely limit the number of people in their house, not attend school. Some of the children that I know have chosen to homeschool because they were constantly getting sick at school. So a lot of those kind of things. You know, children with compromised immune systems or who are otherwise medically fragile have already had to make those changes. And then when you go to the children with more like behavioral issues or different neurotypes like autism, you know, a lot of their triggers are environmental, and so that just means, you know, you weren't going out to restaurants, you weren't going out to the movie theater, like those kind of things were already sort of off limits to these parents.
And now with the pandemic, what additional problems are parents with children with disabilities facing?
Well, one of the ways in which Oregon and a lot of states were trying to mitigate some of those difficulties was through in-home caregiving hours. So these were programs that were set up to pay somebody to come into the home and provide support to the child, try to help them both in the home with their what are called activities of daily living, like bathing and dressing, but also to get them out into the community.
Why has that been a problem to use home caregivers?
So now with the COVID-19 crisis, a lot of those programs have disappeared, you know, because of the inherent difficulty in, well, already there was an inherent difficulty in getting qualified caregivers. So many of the parents that I knew didn't have all of their hours filled. Already it was more like half. And now with the pandemic, many agencies have, you know, pulled back their services and said that caregivers are not allowed in homes anymore. And so now parents are 24/7 caregivers in an extremely difficult situation with no respite.
So I imagine that a lot of parents are experiencing burnout. Seems like this would really exacerbate the the difficulty of giving care 24 hours.
Right, and I think the thing that a lot of policymakers don't fully realize when they set up these programs is that it's not just the physical needs, the extra physical needs of the child. There's a lot of executive managerial work that is involved in having a child with disabilities, whether that's calling to make sure that their formula is coming, calling to fight with the insurance companies, calling to make sure, you know, to redo their appointments that have been suddenly canceled because nobody is allowed at the hospital anymore. There's a lot of extra work that isn't just hands-on with the child that parents are suddenly having to do, and some of them are either also trying to navigate the stress of working from home, or they've lost their job entirely and trying to figure out where their next paycheck is coming from.
And there's a particular policy in Oregon, I believe, which makes it so that parents themselves cannot get paid for in-home caregiving. Is that correct?
That's right. So there's a number of states that do allow parents of minor children to be paid, such as Colorado and California. In Oregon, parents of adult children can be paid, and, you know, even grandparents of minor children can be paid. You know, pretty much everybody except criminals who cannot pass a background check, and parents are the two people who cannot be paid caregivers to minor children. It doesn't make sense to me. The reasons that I've been given from Oregon Developmental Disability Services, which are the folks who administer this program, is that the Oregon's version of Medicaid doesn't allow for this. Now, I have some questions about that because California has the same version of Medicaid that we do, a 1915K. You know, a lot of this gets into really tricky, complicated policy stuff. But what I know for sure is that the states in which this has been made a priority have figured out a way to make it happen, and Oregon does not seem to want it to be a priority.
Does it look like this situation might change?
There's some, yeah, there are groups forming and a lot of questions being asked. UCP, Oregon, Southwest Washington, which is kind of a pan-disability advocacy group, but kind of focused on cerebral palsy, they have been working on this, asking a lot of questions. There are two women down in Eugene, Amy Fellows and Jenny Cannaday, who organized a petition online on change.org. I think it was last Friday, and it very quickly got, I think there's almost 2,000 signatures on it now. And I attribute that to this being not only a crisis issue right now with parents struggling really with kind of life and death decisions about whether they allow the risk into their home, but also with all these financial decisions that everybody's struggling with. And also the kind of long simmering concern among parents that this program was very difficult to use and that they weren't getting the benefit of additional respite anyway, so that it would just be easier if they could have more direct payments. And so we're hopeful that this could change, but I think part of the problem is that there isn't the willpower to do it among state leadership, and so they have not asked the federal government for a waiver to this effect, and so we're not really sure how to change that yet.
You're saying that this is a life and death issue. Can you explain?
So in addition to the thing that everybody's worried about, which is, you know, am I going to be one of the 20% who needs to be hospitalized because of COVID-19, the population of children that we're talking about need hospitalizations on a regular basis, and that's in a good year. And there are triage rules being written up right now that would make it so that children like ours with quote-unquote prior medical conditions would not be given life-saving treatment if there's a surge and there's somebody else who needs that ventilator, for example. So a lot of parents are frankly terrified that that could be their child, whether or not it's COVID-19, just because they have a hospitalization and they need that life-saving equipment, and it is not going to be made available to them. Now, I love my caregivers, and I think that they deserve everything, but I also want to note that the state has been hard at work at providing extra paid time off and classifying these workers as essential workers so that they can have childcare, which is great. I think that's great, but they have been hard at work at providing extra benefits for the workforce and have so far denied any direct benefit to the children and families themselves. And I find that very ironic, because I think as a taxpayer, I would be expecting that the benefits are going first to the children that we're trying to help.
Shasta Kearns Moore is a parent of kids with disabilities, also a journalist, and also a writer who is preparing a book on state policies around providing or not providing, in this case, for the needs of people with disabilities. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is We Are All in This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, 90.7 FM.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are tuned into News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio. And if you can't tell, I'm recording this via Zoom. I'm Jenny Yokoyama. You're one of your interim station co-managers, and I am joined via Zoom by the whole programming team. Program team, say hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Sammy,
hello.
one of the joys of Zoom. So thank you so much, programming team, for joining me. That means I got Althea, our news director, Asia, our program director, interim program director, and Tammy, our public affairs director. And they're all here to talk about what has been going on. It's been a while since actually any of you have been on News from the Boo, and so much has changed. So Althea, let's start with you. What has changed in the land of partial stations shutdown for the news department?
Well, obviously quite a lot. So much of our normal news production is dependent on that space. So there was definitely a learning curve of figuring out how to do it remotely, but we've achieved it, and I'm proud of what we've been able to put together. We have volunteers submitting readers and audio clips to us remotely. We only have one anchor, which is me these days, and I record and under a pile of blankets in my closet and edit it together for air. But that's what the news is right now. And I've actually even been able to get a couple volunteers onboarded to that system. So, you know, onwards and upwards, as it were.
So if you're like a regular news volunteer and are like, you know, kind of familiar with how the news works, is it still the same? Do you still have producers and writers? Like, is the structure basically the same? What has had to change and what's the same?
The structure is generally the same, yeah. So instead of writing pitches up on the whiteboard in the newsroom, we have a Google spreadsheet that all news volunteers have access to, where producers and everyone are writing up their pitches, taking stories, and we've been able to use remote desktop to still be able to use all of our things in the newsroom, so the producer can still run the run sheet and pull audio clips and make sure everything is formatted the way that it normally would be. We just don't get to see each other face to face, unfortunately.
So how much harder is that to produce a daily newscast? Are you finding that you have to start earlier in the day? Is it more time consuming, less time consuming?
Well, to a certain extent, there's less distractions. You know, in person, there's more things that can pull your attention. So I think in that regard, for me, it's been a bit more manageable, but we do move back our deadlines earlier in the day because the editing aspect of putting all of the pieces together does take a little bit of time. And I you know, try not to freak out too much every day worrying about the edit. We've also reduced sort of the regular newscast down to a half hour. Normally we go for 45 minutes, but we